Well, it's back to work for most of you on Tuesday. We've already been back to work for days now, including my entire staff and then a lot of listeners, law enforcement, security, hospital workers, cab drivers, you name it. People have been working and working and working all Labor Day weekend. But you get to go back tomorrow if you had the weekend off. We're coming back in a moment with Richard Lurtzman as we talk about his work with Bill Burns. Dr. Feelgood right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Richard Lurtzman. He wrote the book Dr. Feelgood with Bill Burns. You also wrote The Life and Times of Mickey Rooney, didn't you?
Yes, I did. That's currently out now from Simon & Schuster.
Okay, we got to talk a little bit about that if we have some time, Richard, because he's been a fascinating person. He was probably one of Hollywood's most popular actors at his time, wasn't he?
He was the number one box office star in 38 to 41, and his career lasted 90 years.
Gosh.
2014.
Amazing. And he started off as a boy actor, didn't he?
Yeah, he started out in burlesque at the age of 3. He was a silent film star at the age of 7 years old, playing Mickey Maguire in silent films.
How tall was he, Richard?
About 5'2".
Yeah, just a short guy.
That might be stretching it, too.
Yeah, that was. We'll talk a little bit about him toward the end of this hour. We're going to take calls as well. So let's get back to Dr. Feelgood here. And some of the others that he treated, you mentioned Rod Serling, and Rod broke away from him. Elvis, how many times did Elvis use him?
Colonel Parker was a patient of Max Jacobson. And Colonel Parker, who was not a Kentucky colonel, he was from the Netherlands, had known Max Jacobson in Europe. And so
And when you say patient, everybody went to him for the same thing, these injections?
They went to him for injections, but he would also have, his hours would be from 3 a.m. to 7 a.m. in his office on Lexington Avenue. And every great actor, Anthony Quinn, Christopher Plummer, it'd be a mix of all these great minds and actors and singers, Marion Mercer, opera stars, and they'd all be in his office, and it'd be a cocktail party in his office.
Literally.
Literally. And years ago, Dwayne Hickman, who played Dobie Gillis.
Dobie Gillis, that's right.
And Dwayne worked with Bob Cummings, and Dwayne actually was a friend of both Bill and myself. And Dwayne flew with Bob Cummings there, and he said, I walked in the office, and you know, here's Anthony Quinn on one side, and Truman Capote, and Tennessee Williams, and Alan J. Lerner, who had My Fair Lady and Camelot. And I'm looking around in this dumpy office, and why are all these great people here? And it was the place to be. It was the jet set place to be. George Harrison went there. Van Cliburn nearly lost his finger to Max Jacobson.
Did Max accidentally kill any of his patients?
He did. He He had a long list. In fact, Mark Shaw, who was the White House photographer, was one of Max's closest friends, and he was addicted to methamphetamine, and Max overdosed him with methamphetamine, and his first wife went to the district attorney in New York, and Max had many powerful friends and really was able to really weasel his way out of that, but he did that. He killed Andy Warhol's, I forgot her name, Edie. She was a great experimental. She was a model, and he overdosed her. He overdosed his own wife when he found out she was having an affair with Chuck Spalding, who was John Kennedy's.
He was an investment banker. Spalding was, right?
He was.
Yeah.
And when Chuck Spalding was having an affair with Max's second wife, Max overdosed his second wife, and she passed away.
Oh, he killed her.
He killed her. A.E. Hotchner, one of the great writers, in fact, one of his name is used in The Criminal Minds on television. And Hotch was a partner with Paul Newman and in Newman's Own. They created Newman's Own, the charity. And Hotch wrote an expose on Max back in the 70s, and he shared with us all the information and a lot of files he got from a lot of Max's patients. And it just is just astounding of people that he affected, that he killed,
oh,
that he destroyed.
Tentacles went everywhere. But back to Elvis. So he, do you think he contributed to Elvis's death?
No. Elvis hated Max. He hated being injected. Elvis was more into pills.
He was a pill guy, yeah. He didn't like getting just
when Max would come with two needles, one in each hand, he would come at him. Elvis was just completely freaked out, and he didn't like the response. And although Colonel Parker stayed a patient, you know, Elvis stayed away from that.
Jeez.
He had Dr. Stavros in Nashville.
So the Beatles used him, as you mentioned, Truman Capote, Tennessee Williams.
The Rolling Stones were patients of his. Aretha Franklin used him.
Elizabeth Taylor, what about her?
They were all affected. In fact, she sang a song called Dr. Feelgood, Aretha Franklin, that was based on Max Jacobson. When Cicely Tyson won the Academy Award, she said, "I want to thank MJ, which is Max Jacobson, for getting me here." So, I mean, they a lot of actors credit Max Jacobson for bringing him that creativity that made him successful. Truman Capote said he wrote In Cold Blood, loaded up with methamphetamine.
You've mentioned how he saved Elizabeth Taylor. What happened?
Eddie Fisher brought Elizabeth Taylor, and she became a patient of Max's. And she was very ill in a London hospital. And Max flew to London, and she had actually sepsis. And what Max did was drain the sepsis, and then he was way ahead of the curve of the doctors that were treating her in London. He was actually brilliant as a medical mind. He was trained by some of the great physicians in Europe. So he was a brilliant man. What he was doing with methamphetamine was, he knew it was wrong, and he knew that it affected him in an adverse way.
Well, let's go to the phones now. Greg in Dumont, New Jersey, east of the Rockies. Hey, Greg, go ahead.
Geez, George, this is almost as scary as the people disappearing in the state parks.
Yeah, it really is.
Okay, question for you for your guest. You mentioned that this gentleman taught Dr. Morell, who was Hitler's personal physician.
Yeah, Greg, Dr. Morell was a protege of Max Jacobson.
Oh, my God.
He trained him, first with Pervitin, but he taught Morell how to use the liquid version of methamphetamine. And Hitler was addicted to methamphetamine. In fact, similar to what happened to Kennedy, Hitler went through that same process. Hitler was being injected by Morell once or twice a day with 30 milligrams of methamphetamine.
Jeez.
And Morell used exactly what Max Jacobson had trained him to do.
Wow. Max was a German Jew?
Yes. He was born in Fordor in Russia, but he was raised in Berlin.
And then, obviously, he fled, as you mentioned, when Hitler was starting to do with the evil things he continued to do.
Yeah, he fled to Czechoslovakia, and then he actually treated Henry Miller and June in Paris. He was very big in the Berlin Cafe Society, and Billy Wilder, the great director, and a lot of the great people from that era, from that cafe era, were treated by Max Jacobson, and methamphetamine was part of it at that time.
I knew Gore Vidal, met him at the Polo Lounge in Beverly Hills a couple times, and of course he died several years ago.
Right.
You've got a story about him.
I went to his apartment in New York, and Gore was a very colorful, very opinionated person, and you know, he swore that a lot of the great literary minds were destroyed by Max Jacobson. He believed that Tennessee Williams was destroyed by Max Jacobson, that he really lost his creativity after he stopped using methamphetamine. He had the same feeling with Truman Capote, that he was really ineffective after he stopped using the methamphetamine. And a lot of their creativity came from that. Gore Vidal himself, who he used it, said it just drove him, you know, he just could not do anything. He could not create it. He could not write with that.
We're talking about 60s and 70s money, but what did Max charge per injection, do you know?
He charged about $25. John Kennedy never paid his bill.
Never paid his bill?
Never paid his bill. A lot of people owed him money. Now, here's a great story. He was partners with Stash Radswell. Prince Stash Radswell was Lee Radswell's husband, John Kennedy's brother-in-law, Jackie Kennedy's brother-in-law, and they became partners in a lab in Point Lookout, New York, and created the methamphetamine. He went to McCann Erickson to start to advertise
the advertising company, yeah.
It was the advertising company, and they were going to advertise a drug, and they were selling the drug, Stash Radswell and Max Jacobson, worldwide, shipping it all over the world, and it was almost like a French connection. They would ship it from the East Coast to West Coast of the United States to France. It was being shipped all over the world, and in a lot of countries, it was a controlled substance. But Stash Radswell had a lot of connections. Stash became very wealthy from it. Max did not.
Geez, it's just amazing what this guy was capable of doing. And why didn't Kennedy pay his bill?
He had always told the president, I feel an honor. You know, I'm a United States citizen. This is a great honor to me. And, his wife would send bills to Evelyn Lincoln, and it was never paid.
Let's go to first-time caller Jackie in Los Angeles. Hi, Jackie.
Oh, hi. This is really fascinating tonight. I had a question. Do you think that maybe he accidentally overdosed Marilyn Monroe? I was wondering if he might have been culpable in that.
Good question.
Jackie, I could tell you, Jackie, he treated Marilyn Monroe, and he had a son. His son's name was Tommy Jacobson. And Tommy Jacobson, we interviewed him. That the day of her death, she would self-inject. Max Jacobson and Tommy had taught her to self-inject into the ankle. And so she was given vials that day and given syringes to inject it. Tommy Jacobson believes that it was a mixture of the methamphetamine with everything else she mixed that pushed her over the edge, but he thinks the methamphetamine may have done that. We interviewed Thomas Noguchi, who was the coroner for Monroe, and, you know, the needles that they use, the gauge that they use, is very, very hard to detect because he didn't see any needle injections, but the way this is injected, sometimes it's very hard to see. So we have a strong belief that the methamphetamine did contribute to her death.
Well, you know what's also interesting, Richard, is, of course, there's no secret that Bobby and JFK were both seeing Marilyn in and around the same time. There was always talk that Bobby Kennedy was at Monroe's place when she died or close to that time period. And if JFK was using this methamphetamine from Dr. Feelgood, who knows? Maybe that rumor's correct, too.
And we talked to Peter Lawford's wife, and we looked at Peter Lawford, and Peter Lawford was a patient. And Peter Lawford was there that day. And, you know, we think that Peter Lawford may have contributed because he was a user as well.
What a great story. And when you started writing it with Bill, what were the things that came to you that got you to write the book?
You know, I was researching a book on Bob Cummings, who was known. Bob wrote a book called How to Stay Young and Vital. So he was known to a generation of viewers and fans that he was a really young, youthful man who lived on these vitamins, and he sold millions of books of How to Stay Young and Vital. And I was interviewing Art Linkletter, who was an old host of House Party and Kids Say the Darndest Thing. And Art said, well, the time that we had to put a straitjacket around Bob, I said, wait a second, Bob Cummings? He goes, yeah, we had to take him away. He's a meth addict. And so I started interviewing. I interviewed Ann B. Davis, who was on Love That Bob, and Dwayne Hickman, and then Julie Newmar, who was in a show called My Living Doll.
Yeah.
And they all confirmed that Bob Cummings was a meth addict, and it was from Max Jacobson. And the more I went into it, I switched from Bill and I decided to, instead of writing about Bob Cummings, we wrote about Dr. Max Jacobson because the subject was fascinating, and it led us to some great interviews, everybody from Gore Vidal on that we were able to, you know, we talked to the Secret Service agents who would tell us in detail of how Max Jacobson injected the Kennedys.
When he died in 1979, I think at the age of 79, Was he penniless? Was he rich? What was his finances? What were they like?
He was not well off. He lived in Lexington Avenue. He still had bottles and bottles of vials that he would sell to Jackie Kennedy, to a lot of his patients, even though he was disbarred. And he was just getting by. He was he never became a wealthy man. He liked the power. He liked the
camaraderie.
He liked knowing that he was the president's doctor.
Yeah.
But the money was not a big incentive to him.
Was he invited to social events? I guess so, because they wanted him next to them, right?
We know his daughter very well, Jill Jacobson. So he would go to Martha's Vineyard. He would travel to Florida. I'll tell you, the Mike Samick, who we talked about earlier from AT&T, I went to his apartment on Lexington Avenue. And in his apartment, he had a Matisse on the wall and Renoirs. And in between these great paintings was a photograph from Mark Shaw, the White House photographer, of Jack Kennedy, Max Jacobson, Pierre Salinger, and Chuck Spalding urinating on the side of the road. And that was Mike Samick's treasured possession. So, I mean, he did socialize with them. He went all over the world with John Kennedy, and he got to know them very, very well, and he was considered a part of the inner circle.
What was the reason that Jackie Kennedy started using this stuff?
It gave her the confidence in the White House, first to do the White House tour, but once she started taking methamphetamine, it gave her that confidence, able to appear before audiences. David Heyman, who's a good friend of mine, C. David Heyman, who wrote a lot of Kennedy books, believes that the methamphetamine led to Jackie's lymphoma and led to her death.
Was Max, Dr. Feelgood, an agent of the KGB?
He was. Bill and I went through a lot of the FOIA files, and a lot of it was blacked out. We talked to a lot of agents, and in the files, it was suggested that Max had been, when he came to this country, was already an agent of the KGB. So what we believe is that he was actually funneling information to the KGB about what he was doing with the president, which was even more frightening, and which is another reason the CIA were on alert about Max Jacobson.
Yeah. How did Max die?
Max died. Max was a methamphetamine addict, and he died in his home in New York City he had failure, sepsis. He had, he actually was a very broken man, very bitter, and felt betrayed by everybody, including Jackie Kennedy.
Was he, I mean, the type
And also, George, we have his personal manuscript that he wrote. Bill and I are the only ones to have that.
Oh, boy.
And it's a 400-page manuscript in his own words.
Never published.
He wrote, never published. Never. And it was in David Heyman's archives at Stony Brook, and David gave it to us. And it tells the inside of what he believed. And we included a lot of that in the book.
I bet he names a lot of names.
He does, and he's very bitter. But he still had great respect for the Kennedys, despite what happened.
And Khrushchev knew what was going on, didn't he?
Khrushchev knew Kennedy was weak. He knew that Max Jacobson's office was broken into right before they traveled to the Vienna summit. So they had quite a bit of information about what he was doing and how he was treating Kennedy. So that gave him a great advantage to know that John Kennedy was not only dependent on methamphetamine, but he also took procaine and other drugs. And he thought in fact, Khrushchev's words, it was in Bob Dalek's book, is, I can roll them. I can take care of them.
All right, we're going to come back and take final calls with you, Richard, in just a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Richard Lertzman with us, author of, along with Bill Burns, Dr. Feelgood. Do you know, Richard, if Mickey Mantle was a patient?
Mickey Mantle was a long-term patient. Jane Levy wrote a great book, and Jane helped us with some of the research. I think her book was called The Last Boy. Mickey was brought to Max Jacobson from Mel Allen, who was the great radio announcer.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody thought Mel Allen was an alcoholic because sometimes he would slur his words, Mel was a patient of Max Jacobson's. Mel, in fact, never drank. So Mickey was in the great home run race between him and Roger Maris in 61,
I think.
61, I'm sorry, 61. You're right. And they were in this great battle, and Mickey had an illness, and so Mel said, I have this great doctor, he'll get you well. And he took him to Max Jacobson, and Jacobson injected him in the hip. And Mickey Mantle developed an abscess on the hip because Jacobson used a dirty needle.
Oh.
And that was the end of the race that year. And a lot of people believe that Mickey was not a patient after that. But we talked to quite a few people, including Eddie Fisher, who said that Mickey Mantle was a patient for a lot of years, and also for steroids.
Didn't Mickey miss the World Series that year because of the hip problem?
Yeah, he did, and that was, you know, also he missed that great home run battle between him and Maris, and they were going at it. Mickey was at 50 home runs, and
Maris was at 52. And they just
fired Mel Allen for taking Mantle to the
They did?
Jackson.
Wow. Nobody ever heard about that. That's great inside information.
Yeah, it was interesting, and Mickey was actually the first steroid patient because Max used steroids. And so way before Mark McGuire and everybody else, Mickey Mantle was using steroids to really help him with the Oscar Slaughter, and he had his knee problem, and the steroids from Jacobson actually helped him through more than the medicine.
And they weren't illegal by Major League Baseball, I don't think, were they?
No, not at that time, no.
I probably didn't even know what they were.
No, and Mantle was a long-term patient, and some people believe it really extended his career.
It might have.
Like 67 or 68.
It might have. Do you think Dr. Feelgood did any good at all?
He did good with his multiple sclerosis patients. He helped the MS patients. He didn't charge them. He took away their pain, and one of his favorite sayings is, it's better to feel good than to feel pain. So he did that to help. He alleviated their pain more than, you know, there's no cure for that.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Joe in the Bronx, welcome to the program. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hey, George, you just asked him the question about Mickey Mantle that I was going to ask him. I was just wondering, was Dr. Jacobson ever sued by any of his patients?
He was taken to court more criminally than civilly. Tennessee Williams did sue him. There were different patients. Bob Richardson, who was a great photographer, sued Jacobson, but never successfully. He never really lost a case or a malpractice case.
And you've named a lot of names in the book, and you obviously are pretty adamant that you're correct in some of the information, right?
We went through Max Jacobson's medical files. We saw his medical records. People were in there that we could verify, and we wouldn't put in unless we really had absolute verification of that they were patients of Max Jacobson. And our publisher also made sure that it was very well legally vetted.
Are there other doctors out there, Richard, no names need to be given, that are doing the same thing Max was doing today?
Absolutely. And Bill and I are working on a book. It continues to this day. Prince, Conrad Murray, you know, who treated Michael Jackson. There are doctors who continue in the same vein as Max Jacobson, and it continues the same way. I mean, they're treated by the Dr. Feelgoods of this generation.
Why don't they stop? Is it the money?
You know, they find every loophole. You know, with Prince, they have doctors that they had called shoppers, that people would go out and shop and get drugs under their own names, and you know, and they continue to this day. I mean, methamphetamine to this day, the way Max created it, it still exists. There are still doctors who do it. Right now, it's a Class 2 narcotic, so it's not the same as in Max's day, but it's still done.
Is it illegal today?
It's illegal today, unless it's a Class 2 narcotic, so it's very carefully controlled due to Max Jacobson and due to the laws they created.
And they're still injecting people in the artery in the neck?
For the most effective way, the liquid version of methamphetamine, the injectable, is the most effective. It's far more effective than what we saw in Breaking Bad with Walter White and his blue methamphetamine.
When something goes awry, what is it, a heart attack?
There's a lot. It's a curve that it can take you very high, and then you crash very low, and you can go into psychotic an effect from that. Coming off of it, it can also kill you. You just can't go cold turkey off methamphetamine, this type of methamphetamine.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Jim in Houston, Texas. Hey, Jim, go ahead.
Hey, thank you so much.
Sure thing.
For taking my call. I tell you, this topic will also kind of stir up a little bit of aggravation on some of the pro-JFK conspiracy sites. I actually was kind of talking about this today, and one of the things I kind of pointed out was JFK smoked marijuana in the White House because of his Addison's disease. And the topic, of course, your guest is talking about here is that, you know, a lot of people do not know that JFK did have to use a lot of drugs every day just to function.
Yeah, well, he had to for sure. Tomorrow, by the way, I'll be talking with Jesse Ventura about his thoughts on drugs and marijuana. But Kennedy was out of control, Richard, I think.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Max Jacobson was a friend of Dr. Timothy Leary, and he brought Timothy Leary to the White House where he did experiment with LSD.
I mean, no question, Kennedy was in pain most of his life, you know, with his Addison's disease and his bad back, you know, and everything else that went wrong with him. But I still think he was out of control.
You know, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it affected him that he was out of control. And who knows what would have happened if he had lived and he continued in the vein and continued to have Max Jacobson as a doctor, along with his own White House physicians who also supplied him with narcotics.
The Jackie story surprises me. I would have thought she would have known better, but sounds like she got addicted too.
She was. To the end of her life, she had used methamphetamine.
Gosh. And she died after he did, right? After Lertzman? I mean, after Max?
Oh, yeah. She died, I think, 20-something years after Max Jacobson passed away.
So she found somebody else to supply
her.
She
found a Max Jacobson substitute on Park Avenue who continued on with the same treatment.
Richard Lutzman with us. You have a Facebook account, Richard, that we've got linked up for you, right?
You do, and they can go view that, and the Mickey Rooney book, and Dr. Feelgood, and we have an upcoming book on Peter Falk.
Oh, do you? Oh,
and
cool.
It's been fascinating just interviewing Joe Mantegna and Paul Reiser we talked to, and all these, everybody loved Peter Falk, and what a great, colorful life he led.
Oh, yeah, he sure did. Let's go to Pat in Minneapolis. Hi, Pat. Go ahead.
Since Jacobson was a student of Carl Jung, one of the greatest psychiatrists of all times, did he have an inkling that JFK had multiple personality? And I'll refer you to one of his last biographers who remarked on a Mimi Alford interview with Meredith Vieira. And Mimi Alford was the teenage intern that was at the White House who had an affair with JFK for about a year and a half.
I don't think he was aware of any multiple personalities. Max was less of a psychiatrist than he was more of a technical. He was a research, a chemist, a surgeon, but he trained. When he developed Pervitin and methamphetamine, he developed it with Carl Jung. That the original treatment. That's what it was created for.
I'm pretty sure that Seymour Hersh mentioned some of this in his book, The Dark Days of Camelot.
Cy Hersh was a big help in the book. He shared a lot of files, and he absolutely did. Cy Hersh talked to a lot of Secret Service agents that he turned us on to that we interviewed for our book.
Let's go to Pocatello, Idaho. Kat's with us now. Hey, Kat, go ahead.
Good morning, Richard and
George.
We were in 1971 or 72. You mentioned Elvis, and we watched Elvis on stage. And when he came on, right off the bat, he was just sweating like a piggy. And we were front row seats. He was throwing the scarves out. Are you there?
Yeah, we're listening. Yeah.
He was throwing the scarves out from around his neck, wipe his face off, and he'd throw them out in the audience. You mentioned Elvis, but you didn't continue on. Was he being treated by Dr. Jacobson?
No, he didn't like needles. Am I correct, Richard?
Yeah, it was a very short period for Elvis. Elvis was treated by a doctor in Memphis, and that he just did not like Max Jacobson's injection. He didn't like the injectables.
Skype is open, folks, at George97313. We're with Richard Lertzman talking about his work with Bill Burns called Dr. Feel Good. Let's go to Alley Cat in Muncie, Indiana. Hi, Alley Cat, go ahead.
George, how you doing?
All right.
I had a question. Well, actually, I heard a story about this mess stuff. I remembered it when your guest started talking about the Nazi part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the town I live in, it's an epidemic here. It's just crazy. So you hear all kinds of stuff about that junk. But the story I heard several times was that the Nazis were the ones who originally developed that meth because their scientists were trying to find a way to get their soldiers to be, like, real in sync with each other and be able to, you know, communicate with each other by using, you know, more, like, telepathy type stuff. You know, Hitler was into all kinds of strange stuff. And that it make them, you know, a more, you know, cohesive unit of, you know, children.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right.
I was wondering if your guests had ever heard that version of it.
Alley Cat, actually, yes. The Germans did develop it. They were the first to develop it because Max Jacobson was actually part of it. And they developed it for the German Air Force so they could fly longer hours. And so they were able to get more out of their soldiers and used a drug called Pervitin, which is a pill version of what he had created. And it was able to allow them to fly longer, to longer hours. They also used it on soldiers, and there's been quite a few stories about the use of Pervitin and methamphetamine on German soldiers.
Okay, and let's talk a little bit about the life and times of Mickey Rooney and the moments that we have left, and we'll take final calls as well. But Mickey was a superstar. As you talked about, he was one of the biggest box office attractions in his time, wasn't he?
He was a huge star for 90 years. You know, the amazing span that he started, where he started in silent films and he ended up with Ben Stiller in Night at the Museum in 2014, he worked until 2 weeks before he died. He just had such an amazing career, and he reinvented himself over and over and over, but he had such a dark life. 8 wives. Ava Gardner was his first wife.
And Sinatra loved Ava Gardner too, right?
Sinatra loved him. Sinatra married Ava Gardner after Mickey.
All right.
And then, we talked to a lot of his wives, his kids. We got to know Jan, his last wife. He had that famous case that came at the end of his life that said there was senior abuse, and we talked to his whole family about that. But it's just such a dark story. And here's a man who made millions and millions of dollars and at the end of his life could afford a headstone. And he had made, we talked to Sean Levy, the director of Night at the Museum, who had paid him 2 weeks before he died $250,000 to appear in Night at the Museum. And by the time he died 2 weeks later, he didn't have $18,000 to pay for his headstone.
Where'd it go?
You know, we tried to follow the money, and there was a lot of family, a lot of involvement, but he died almost completely broke.
Was he generous?
He was a compulsive gambler. His joke was, I bet $2 at Santa Anita, and I spent $3 million trying to get it back the rest of my life. And he just blew money. He had huge contracts. He was making $75,000 a week in Vegas, and he crossed gamblers. And Gus Greenbaum from the Sahara Hotel had his head cut off due to Mickey Rooney, because Mickey Rooney played all kind of tricks with gamblers.
He had his head cut off, like the mob cut his head off?
The mob cut Gus Greenbaum and his wife's head off.
Jeez.
There was discrepancies in the book, but the last straw was when messed up with Mickey Rooney as a headliner, and Mickey ran out and left him with the bag at the Sahara, And that was the last straw for Meyer Lansky. And we got into such dark stories. I interviewed Mickey's son, who just passed away a month ago. His name was Teddy Rooney. And he was in hospice, and he had cirrhosis of the liver. And he said, "I've got to tell you my father's story." And he had a respirator, and he told us this dark story about what his father did to the family. And it was just so sad, so dark. But it was a fascinating, you know, here's a talent who appeared in 400 movies, hundreds of TV shows. He was in Sugar Babies. He was making $75,000 a week for 4 years, and he ended up broke.
That's sad. Obviously, health was good. He lived into his 90s.
He lived into his 90s. He was active. The day before he passed away, he was at the racetrack with Mel Brooks and Dick Van Patten.
How did he die? What finally happened to him?
He was at his stepson's house, and he just went in for a nap and never woke up.
Never woke up. That's the way to go. Peaceful.
At 93 years old.
Let's go to Betty in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Betty. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just had a question about President Kennedy.
Yeah.
Do they not have a White House physician that would be monitoring him? Would he not question this, or would he not have any?
They should have had a White House physician, Richard. Did they at that time?
Yeah, they had Dr. Janet Travell. Was the main White House physician. She hated Max Jacobson. She questioned everything he did. She checked every record he did. She did everything with the other White House physicians that were part of the team to really get him, push him away from Max Jacobson. But the president was the president, and he said, no, Max is my personal physician. So Max wasn't a White House physician. Janet Travell was the official White House physician.
So between her and Bobby Kennedy, they couldn't stand the guy, but the president was the president, right?
He made the decision, and he just loved Max Jacobson. He loved what he did, and he loved the injections.
Gosh, three times a week?
Three times a week, and they would increase dosages at different times, which made it him almost ineffective at times.
If Kennedy would travel abroad, would he bring Max with him?
Yes. When he went to the Vienna summit, Max was on Air Force One. Max traveled with him to Florida. Max traveled with him to Johannesburg. Max was with him right at his side. And he would just, he was, you know, since 1960, Max was right there with both Jackie and John.
Amazing. Richard, good luck with this book. Keep in touch with everything you do and with Bill, okay?
Thank you, George, so much. We
really appreciate it. The name of this book, of course, Dr. Feelgood. He's also got one, The Life and Times of Mickey Rooney, and, of course, all of Bill's books. They're on Amazon.com as well, including The Day After Roswell. And he wrote three books with me, The Worker in the Light, Journey to the Light, and Late Night Snacks. That's right, a cookbook. We'll be back.